Hi, today's March 11th, 2018. This is MoViews Podcast number 245. Happy Daylight Savings to those of you who shifted over to it this morning. John is one of them. I am not.
Yeah, it's somewhat happy, but it's also somewhat annoying.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, I always found it annoying when I lived on the mainland. Here in Hawaii, like Arizona, and I think a corner of Indiana, although they may have changed, we do not switch back and forth from standard time to daylight savings. So I don't have any of this spring forward, fall back stuff. But I did read that both California and Florida are considering a permanent shift to daylight savings time, which could be interesting for their neighbors. I mean, you know, you could drive down from Oregon to California and need to shift by an hour, even though you're in the same longitude.
It would be a really interesting thing for California, considering there really are only three states in that time zone. So,
Nevada's in Pacific time, I think.
I thought Nevada was still in mountain.
Let me check. Let's do some real-time podcast checking here. States in Pacific time. Okay, let's see. California, Washington, Oregon, and Nevada.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, wait. Is there one more? Yeah, I guess it's those four.
And then chunks of Canada.
Yeah, yeah. So, and similarly for Florida, you know, there's a bunch of states in the Eastern time zone. So.
Well, it does seem that if you are on the western side of a time zone,
yeah,
you really like the idea of just going to daylight savings time all the time. And I didn't really realize that until I had lived in Ohio, which is on the western side of one time zone, and then moved to New York.
Yeah, same time zone.
And you realize there's a big difference between certain times of the year, 6 o'clock in Ohio versus 6 o'clock in New York.
Yeah. Well, if you want to see something really extreme in terms of time zones, all of China is one time zone.
Yeah. Well, that just seems like...
It's wider and larger than the U.S.
I would be fine if we all just went to, like, UTC. I could live with the idea that instead of getting up at 8 in the morning, I now get up at, you know, 2 in the afternoon or something like that. Nobody really likes that proposal, I don't think.
Yeah, but, you know, from a tech point of view, I was just thinking of all the poor programmers who have to deal with time zones in general and now would have to deal with even more exceptions to the rule. So.
Well, I really like the meme that went by yesterday that was, you know, leave your smartphone alone because it just figures it out by magic.
So true. So true. Okay. At any rate, so happy daylight savings to those of you who sprang forward, I guess. I'm pretty happy not having to do any of this springing or falling or anything else. Next item on my list is a thank you to my friend Ricky Lee, who's been a panelist on this podcast a number of times, that we had lunch the other day, and he gave me his Google Daydream VR, I don't know what you want to call it, goggles, I guess. Mm-hmm. It had gone on sale on President's Day a few weeks ago, and I was considering buying it and posted to Facebook saying, hey, has anybody bought this thing? What do you think of it? And Ricky said, hey, I'm not using mine. You want to get mine? So I said, sure. And so I plugged it in, and I just want to say, you know, I thought it was going to be basically a nicer, fancier version of Google Cardboard glasses, which some of you may remember is about $30 for the cardboard version, $20 for the plastic version. You figure that one out. I bought a pair of the $20 plastic versions, and, you know, I kind of used it for a while and then didn't go back to them, but... I kind of expected the Daydream VR to be more or less the same, except it has a remote control, which is kind of neat. It pairs via Bluetooth with your phone. John is distracting me by knitting, by the way, while we do this. Yeah, these.
Well, you know, I have to, for what I'll talk about at the end, I have to prove my credibility. Okay. So you have a remote control and you have goggles now.
Right.
So what have you done with this power that you have?
Well, again, you know, I thought it'd be interesting. I thought it'd be better than cardboard because of the, you know, the ability to remote control stuff. It is a VR. It's not AR. So once you put the goggles on, all you see is whatever is on the lens. You put your compatible phone, and not all Android phones are compatible, but the Pixel 2 is. So I put my Pixel 2 in the goggles, and it provides the video. So it's the goggles itself, with exception of the remote control, the goggle itself is completely passive. There's no power, there's no charging, there's no connecting to your phone for power or data or anything else. It's basically just an optical device that takes the two images that are presented on your Android phone screen and then integrates them into a stereoscopic scene or something else. But here's the interesting thing that I didn't realize. So I played with it a bit. You can do Netflix VR, which is not really VR. You can just basically see Netflix on your goggles, which is kind of interesting. The resolution's a little low because essentially it splits the Netflix video stream into two, half resolution images, and then integrates them via optically on your eyes. So you think you're seeing a large screen. There's a lot of spherical aberration or something like it. And that was the first thing I tried, so I was a little disappointed. But then I started playing with some other VR apps that are available, and I was undisappointed because they were pretty darn good.
You were appointed.
Yeah, I was pointed. But then finally, the last thing I tried was what really surprised me, and that was Google Photos. And the reason for that is Google Photos can store what's called Google Cardboard camera images in a VR format. In fact, if you ever take a Google Cardboard camera image, and I've done a number, not a lot, but a number, you'll see them in Google Photos labeled as VR, at least in an Android phone. So what really shocked me was it will do panoramic photos as kind of a quasi VR, where you can look around at the scene and so forth. But the interesting thing is I guess true VR or near true VR, something that you use with Google Cardboard. There's something more remarkable. It must do something with parallax, because this the phones I use, the Pixel 2 and earlier the Nexus 6, only have a single camera on the back. Actually, all the Google phones only have a single. None of them are stereoscopic. Mm-hmm. But it must be to do something with parallax, with the natural hand jitter or something, because the VR images are in 3D, and they recorded a bit of sound associated with the still 3D image. So, for example, when I looked at our pet that we lost a few weeks ago, he was in 3D, and there was ambient sound, wind going by and birds chirping and that sort of thing, and it's really startling. So I had not seen that in Google Cardboard Viewer. In fact, I'm not even sure that your Google Cardboard Viewer tells you to plug in your headset, but it did record sound. The Daydream does tell you put on headset, which is interesting because I couldn't find my USB-C adapter or my USB-C headphones, so I had to use a Bluetooth headset.
And what's generally the price for the Daydream?
I think the Daydream lists for $100, and it was on sale for like $70 or $80 on President's Day. And of course, Ricky was nice enough just to give me his. He said he got his free with the first Pixel that came out last year. This year, if you bought a Pixel, you got a Google Home Mini as your freebie.
I think the Daydream was a better freebie.
I think so too now. Although, it's not something you put on all the time. You do have to charge the remote control with a USB-C charger, which it does not come with, but that's okay. I have a cable for it, so it's not a big deal. But at any rate, it was really, really, really much cooler than I expected. And I've used it a couple of times since I got it on Thursday now. So thanks to Ricky. Really appreciate the freebie handover to me.
Well, and you, I would say you and I both like taking photos, mm-hmm. but you probably out-photo me by about a magnitude of 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really cool idea, and I really like the idea that it took those photos that you didn't even realize at the time were going to be useful for this and was able to use those. That's really cool forward thinking on Google's part to say, you know what, this is something that we're going to want in future devices, so let's build it in.
Yeah, and now my only regret now is I didn't take more cardboard photos. Mm-hmm. Because it was kind of like, I can't even find my cardboard glasses anymore kind of thing. But every now and then I kind of took it just in case I find my cardboard glasses. And I wish I'd taken more now.
And let's not forget, there are some unintended fun consequences of these things. My wife was just asking me before the podcast, mm-hmm. Do I think that her mother realizes that every photo she sends is a live photo? And I said, no, I don't, but it does provide some interesting audio commentary here and there, you know, when people think that they're just taking a photo and not taking a live photo. So, you know, there are those unexpected benefits. Of-
well, actually, it's interesting. You know, my wife and daughter were traveling several years ago, right after live photos became available on the iPhone. And for those who don't know, a live photo is a normally still image which has a little mini video with sound. Mm-hmm. Associated with it, and so you can view it either way, still or like a mini, you know, 3 second video. Yep.
Anyway, basically a second or so before you hit the shutter button and a second or so after.
And they were in like a butterfly garden, you know with a covered one, so the butterflies don't escape and stuff. And so they took a whole bunch of photos of these butterflies. She didn't realize she had live photo on, and so when we saw the live, I said, hey, these are live photos. So I tapped the screen and the butterfly's wings fluttered, and it added that dimension that's quite remarkable. I mean, the butterflies themselves are beautiful, but now you can see them both still and a bit of motion. They're really, really fascinated.
It's also great if you are capturing something that you would normally maybe use burst mode for, mm-hmm. just to get the exact moment, but you don't think, oh, gee, I should use burst mode. Well, if you're in live photo and you realize, oh, I didn't quite get it, sometimes hitting that shows you, oh, yeah, I did get the moment that I cared about. And yeah, it's not the still, but it's still in the moment. Over Christmas, I had a couple of those where it was, oop, I didn't get exactly, oh, but I have a live photo of it.
Yeah. I wonder if it's possible to decompose a live photo file into its component still images. That'd be kind of interesting to research.
It probably is.
Yeah, that'd be kind of interesting to research. Because it's certainly easier than setting burst mode. Just my opinion.
Yeah.
And I know on a regular digital camera, burst mode is like crazy. You know, you'll get 20 photos, which is what you're supposed to get. But do I really want to save 20 images? okay, next up. And this is only good for this week. It started on March 10th, which is yesterday for us, Saturday. If you have Google Maps, I haven't tried it. Did I try it in iOS? Yes. It's available for both Android and iOS. You can have... Mario from Super Mario Brothers on your map, leading you to your destination with a few sound effects at the beginning and end, but nothing in the middle. So it doesn't do a Super Mario turn-by-turn, for example, announcement.
See, I would want it to be full Mario Kart.
Yeah.
I'd want, you know, blue shells to come after me and, you know, Mario to deflect them or something like that. But, right. I did see this yesterday and thought it was a really cool idea.
It was. It
is.
And it's still active. It's active for 1 week, I assume, starting yesterday, March 10th, and I'll guess ending 7 days later on Friday. So if you hear this podcast before the end of the week of, what is today, 11th? March 11th, try it out. I tried it yesterday. It was kind of fun.
And if you don't hear this podcast by then, what are you doing with your life that you're waiting so long to listen to our podcast?
What's wrong with you people? All righty. Next up, this is, I think, resolved. I didn't hear it. Nobody I know have heard it. But Alexa was
cackling.
Alexa, stop cackling.
Actually, so I did hear this to some extent because I asked Alexa to do it.
Oh.
So the way that this the problem this was apparently the phrase Alexa laugh was easy enough for Alexa to pick out of everyday conversation. Of course, that also seems like something if a programmer was a little mischievous, they'd also make it easy enough to pick out of everyday conversation. So I did ask Alexa to laugh just so I could hear this. And it's not that creepy, but it would be weird if you weren't expecting it.
Right. So they changed the trigger phase. But, you know, I kind of wonder about that explanation because I read, you know, again, nobody I know has experiences, but I read that a few people reported it happened in the middle of the night when presumably nobody would say anything, unless you snore or unless you talk in your sleep, I guess.
Or your pets are plotting against you or something. It's a weird one, but I thought it was somewhat somewhat humorous, but also it underscored that Alexa, you know, for people talking about how Siri is not that smart.
Right.
Siri has never cackled at night to me, so... You know, I guess you got to give Alexa a little bit of a break.
And neither has the Google Assistant, in my experience.
Yeah.
And speaking of the Echo, so one of the things that got added as an option, and by default it's off, so you have to go into your control panel. On the web, you can go to echo.amazon.com and, and set up a follow-up mode where it understands a follow-up command if said within a few seconds without the trigger word. So, for example, and I'm going to turn my microphone a bit, I can say, Alexa, weather?
Right now in Honolulu, it's 71 degrees Fahrenheit with cloudy skies. Throughout the day, you can expect more of the same, with a high of 78 degrees and a low of 67 degrees.
Weather tomorrow?
Tomorrow in Honolulu, there will be showers, with a high of 78 degrees and a low of 69 degrees.
So you notice I didn't have to say a trigger word in between the two commands.
Mm-hmm.
And even right now as I'm speaking, the Echo's alert light ring is still on waiting for me to say a follow-up command. I assume it'll...
Still listening,
right, for a follow-up. And it just went off, so I would have to use a trigger word again to activate it. What it doesn't have, however, is actual persistence of the information asking for. So, for example, if I asked it for the weather in San Francisco, right, weather San Francisco, it would give me the weather for San Francisco. But then if I said weather tomorrow, it would give me the weather for local, Honolulu. It wouldn't remember that I said or know that I said San Francisco in the previous command. It's literally just listening to the commands.
So it's just commands without the trigger word.
Right.
So you couldn't do something like, Alexa, what's the weather tomorrow and or today? And then afterwards say, what about tomorrow?
I can say that only because it would do it locally for both.
My Alexa in two rooms over is now telling me about a flood warning. So
we have
definitely triggered many people's Alexas.
Which is why I try not to say the trigger word. any rate, so that there's a... If you go into, again, you can go into the iOS app, but if you go into echo.amazon.com on the web, there is, in settings, there's something called follow-up mode, and you just turn it on to activate it. Otherwise, it's off by default.
One of the things that I came across this week as a thing for people who may not have realized that this is an option. One of my friends set up an Echo for her parents over mm-hmm. Christmas, mm-hmm. and it's set up under her account
right. Because
it was just easier to do that than right. Try to get it under your parents. And she told me one day, she goes, I tried to call my parents and they weren't answering their phone, and I got a little concerned about it. I said, well, you could just drop into their Echo. And because when you set up an Echo and you are the owner of the Echo, you can drop in on your Echo at any time and it doesn't require any kind of confirmation on the other end. It just literally starts, beeps and someone's there. So that's an option that you might not have thought about with people who are, her parents are not particularly elderly or disabled in any way, but it would be a nice thing when you have an elderly parent or person that you want to check in on to know that, hey, if I have to, I can just set it up and I can get in there. And if, someone's fallen or they're hurt or something like that, I can hear them talking to me because they didn't have to actually trigger it at all.
Yeah.
So. And it's just nice and creepy if you don't like people to, spy on them.
Right. And maybe, let's see, would this work? If you buy them a Fire TV, and I don't recommend it. My Fire TV broke in less than a year and Amazon wouldn't replace it. Only time I had problems with Amazon customer service. But at any rate, I think the new Fire TV has an Echo-enabled remote control. So it doesn't have a speaker. But technically, you could call them and maybe it would hear you, because if you asked your parents or whoever, grandparents, to wear their Fire TV remote on their neck like a pendant. I don't know how that would fly, but you know what I'm talking about here. At least they'd
have wear your Fire TV, wear your Fire pendant at all times.
That way you'll never lose your remote control.
Well, yeah, that's a good thing.
And it's tiny, right? So
as you get older, you sometimes get more forgetful. So
yeah.
Having your remote always there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, this one, the next item is something that confused me at first. And I wondered, what are they talking about? So I read that Google has a new Python class. And I'm thinking, I wonder why. Why would they have a object, their own object for Python? I thought, maybe it's to talk to Google Docs or, make it easier to do something with their API. No, it's an actual class.
It's an actual class.
it's a free class. For people with, they say, with a little bit of programming experience who want to learn Python. It includes written materials, lecture videos, lots of code exercises to practice Python coding. So, and they also say these materials are used within Google to introduce people, new employees, I would assume, who have a little programming experience and want to learn. And, you know, Python's my favorite programming language. I haven't done it in years, but there was a time not that long ago when I used to write Python every day, and it was just a wonderful experience. It's a wonderful programming language. And if you have a little bit of programming experience, you want to learn more, I highly recommend going to try Python. And I haven't looked at Google's Python class, but I think I should to refresh myself and get back into it, because I really enjoyed using that. It runs on pretty much everything except a Chromebook. And I think even there you can get like a Chrome app that gives you a Python editor and lets you actually run Python in the cloud.
Going to say, are we a little bit surprised that it runs everywhere except a Chromebook?
Isn't that funny?
That is a little bizarre.
Yeah,
but
that is funny. But I mean, you know, presumably, in Google, you can get your Chromebook and you just, you know, log into a server and there you go. So
And you can take the class and then you can write your own class.
There you go,
the Todd class Python.
That's right. Now, what you could do is you could, you know, remote your Chromebook to something else, to some little server or Raspberry Pi or something like that, and use that as your Python engine.
It's interesting that that idea has never really taken off.
What's that?
You remember there were a number of products. CloudOn was one of them.
Yeah.
Where you were literally connecting to full versions from iOS or Android of, in this case, Microsoft Office and Windows and all that. It's interesting to me that never took off, where we thought that maybe that could be a full-time thing for people with Chromebooks or whatever, that when you needed the full operating system, you would just have a subscription that would give you access to a Windows client or a Mac client or something like that.
Yeah, and I think for the Chromebook itself, at least, now that it has Android apps, if you really need an app, you can run an Android app. And otherwise, which I personally rarely find the need to do, I thought it was going to be the number one thing I did with my new Chromebook when I got my Chromebook Plus almost a year ago, I think. But so far, I've rarely used the Android apps. In fact, the only Android app I use doesn't work correctly anymore. And oddly enough, it's Google. It's Google's, what is it called, the movie app? The one that plays, you know, you can stream or download movies and TV videos that you buy from the Google Play Store. And so what I mean by that is at some point in the last two months, it stopped being able to play back downloaded videos. You can still stream video. That works fine. But you can't download a video to your Chromebook. And quite frankly, the reason I prefer to download the movies and videos I buy from the Google Play Store is because the dynamic streaming algorithm Google uses is not as good as what Netflix does. And so you will see, on the exact same network, you will see some stutter and other artifacts in your streaming that don't appear in Netflix.
Yeah, and I like just being able to download things just for travel. Even if I don't travel that often, one of the reasons why when I bought my iPad Pro, I went for the 256 was so that movies that I have either on Plex or on iTunes, both of those allow for offline downloading. It would have it there just so I could watch it whenever I feel like it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't travel much, but, you know, when I do travel, maybe once a year or twice a year or so, it's not, you know, any place from Hawaii is 5 hours away, minimum. So, so you know, I try to take a bunch of stuff with me to watch and listen to audiobooks and TV series, binge watch TV series, that sort of thing. So let's see. The next thing up is I haven't really delved into it. The project just started. It's by a well-known open source guy, Eric Raymond. It's called the UPS. Actually, it's called Upside Project, or UPS in caps, you know, uninterruptible power supply IDE. It's an Upside Project. It's an open source UPS design. So he ranted a couple of weeks ago, I guess, about the problems with current, you know, consumer grade commercial UPSs with battery life and replacing the battery and all kinds of other problems with batteries. UPSs in general. And said there must be a way to design a better UPS. So he was ranting and people started volunteering some information. So if you are interested in this thing, they're looking for a lead engineer and that sort of thing, but they already got some, I think, specs and ideas and how to develop it. And I think it's a really interesting project. You know, anybody who's used a UPS or wants to use a UPS knows that they're invaluable when the time strikes, when, you know, power just blinks out on you or goes out completely. And even for riding, if properly designed, even for riding through brownouts and things. But they are kind of expensive. They do kind of die fast. Typical UPS will last, what do you think, John, in your experience? A couple of years, maybe?
Yeah, a couple of years. In fact, when I just bought my latest one, one of the things that I was very happy to see was a replaceable battery.
Yeah.
Because they do die so quickly, in a sense. And plus, yeah. Once you have one, you know, if you don't live anywhere with electronics disposal, yeah. Getting rid of those batteries can be a real pain.
Absolutely. There are lead acid batteries so that you can't just take them in the trash. Basically, you have to wait for some kind of electronics recycling event in your neighborhood. And sometimes they won't take lead acid batteries.
Yep.
They'll only take, you know, like PCs and things like that with minimal battery type of things. So, yeah, it is a problem trying to recycle them correctly and in an environmentally safe way. But at any rate, it's the UPS project. I will post a link to the blog associated with this podcast. It's on Eric Raymond's personal site, so esr.ibiblio.org, and you can look for it in his blog. Really interesting stuff. Anyway, John, as you continue to knit and distract me as I try to talk.
Well, you know, so I'll talk about that in a moment. The first thing I want to talk about, I started playing a game yesterday, or actually 2 days ago, yeah. Called Plague Inc. It's got a 4.6 star rating on the App Store, and it's a strategy game. But what makes it unique is that you, as the name might entail, plague, you don't play as a team of researchers trying to fight a plague. You play as the plague. And your goal is to infect and then kill everyone in the world, which is a really kind of, and you can mutate and you build different immunities to things and all these, and you start out playing as a bacteria. And then as you get better at the game, you can level up and become a fungus and other random things. So it's just an interesting – it is at its core a real-time strategy game in that you're making these decisions and seeing how they play out. It's a plague simulator in the same way that the game that I played a few weeks ago is the Subway Simulator. But it does teach you a lot about infectious disease and about how – containment can happen and all those things. So if you are curious, it's 99 cents for the game. There are a bunch of in-app purchases, but as far as I can tell, the only things that you can't unlock in the game are scenarios, different sets of scenarios and expansions, that sort of thing. But the actual, level up abilities, you can unlock all of those either with money if you are impatient, or you can play through and get those unlocked. So that's kind of a fun game, although my wife refuses to play it. She says it's too depressing.
Yeah, but if you have a grudge with a virologist or epidemiologist, this is kind of a nice non-violent way to deal with that, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend having grudges with epidemiologists anyway. So that was the first thing I want to point out. The next thing, as Todd has alluded to, since we've started podcasting, I have been sitting over here knitting.
And I can see him on video, by the way.
Which is sort of a strange, when I tell people that I took up knitting it's been almost exactly a month. They kind of look at me like, "What? Why?" And I thought, well, honestly, to be quite blunt about it, there was a number of reasons. The first, though, and foremost, was every spring I usually pick up a new game on iOS or Android, and just it takes over my life for a while. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I might as well do something that's productive. And at the end of life, or at the end of this, I'll actually have stuff that I made. That and my wife drags me into a lot of craft stores, and I got really tired of not caring about anything there. But what I've been doing as a computer geek who now knits has been looking at what options there are for people who are into knitting and into other things. And it's an interesting field. There's basically one website that has a ton of resources and is sort of the knitting social network Which, Todd, did you even know there was a knitting social network?
No, I can't say I did.
Yeah, it does exist. It's Ravelry.com, and you can set up a social profile there and catalog all of your projects and things like that. So we'll put a link in the show notes if anyone's curious. I can link them to my profile on Ravelry. Mm-hmm. My wife's profile is Carrie64. Mine is Carrie64's husband. because initially their website was designed just for you had to have an account to see things, and my wife would be posting things there, and I wanted to see what she was posting, and I had to have an account for it. Yeah. But there are other things that you don't see much evolved where you might think so. So, for example, there are apps for your phone that can count what row you're on and things like that, but you don't see a lot of quick reference apps or Ravelry itself has a mobile-optimized website. They don't have an app, so it's kind of interesting to be in a field that is embracing technology, as many of its practitioners are getting more and more tech-savvy. Knitting definitely gets associated with people in the above 65 crowd, but there are people of all ages that are getting into it, especially just like everything else, with the internet being the way it is, people are learning about it. So I definitely recommend, if you get into a hobby that is not very technologically savvy, keep an eye and watch the evolution, because it kind of gives you an idea of what the general evolution of the internet was way back before we had things like, you know, the social networks that we all know, and regular email access and instant messaging, all those things.
Hmm. You just got me curious. I went to go see if there was a social network for rabbits, and there is, bunspace.com. So there you go.
Well, now, you know, and can you make a profile for your rabbits on there?
I think so. There are even most viewed rabbits, and adopting one, and search for a vet.
Maybe Pepper can, you know, be the rabbit of the month or something.
Yeah, something like that. Well, she'd rather be a leader of the world, but, you know.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I guess so.
Start with rabbit of the month, you become leader.
Alrighty, and that's about all I have. I guess this is one of the rare short port podcasts we have had, or shorter podcasts. So that's about it. Let's see. I think spring break is coming up for some folks in a couple, either this week or next week or next couple of weeks. So
yeah, a lot of people are heading out. This is the week that we technically have spring break, although I'll be in my office working on things mostly uninterrupted. So that's sort of a nice.
That's nice.
That's my break. I get to work without
interruptions.
As many meetings.
That's awesome. And you can knit.
I can, although I'll actually be typing quite a bit. So,
yeah.
You know.
So that, you know, the other thing with knitting. Okay, so two questions I have about knitting. One, because it requires both hands and your eyes, presumably. I guess some people can do it without looking. You can't do anything else, really, right? You can't even watch.
Listen to podcasts. To a book.
Yeah.
Listen to books.
Yeah.
You can.
It's kind of like driving.
Although I've tried watching TV while knitting, and you can sort of do it. You can take these glances up between stitches. But yeah, it is one of those things where, and the ironic part about it was I always felt very guilty about listening to podcasts or books at home.
Oh.
Because for some reason I could be sitting on my couch listening or watching a TV show, and that doesn't seem weird at all.
No.
But sitting there and just staring off into space while listening to a podcast, that seemed a little strange.
I have to say, I feel the same way. So when I'm at home, and I do listen to a lot of podcasts at home, but I tend to be doing things.
Yeah. So this was my, okay, I'll do something. I will sit there and knit.
Right.
The other thing.
Sit and stare into near space instead of far space. Yeah.
And the other thing that I should mention is that knitting is one of the very few socially acceptable things to do in public that people don't assume that you're ignoring them when you're doing.
That's an interesting observation.
I've seen people in meetings just pull out knitting needles and start knitting and, you know, holding a conversation. We've been talking throughout this podcast, and I've kept up with what you're saying without a problem.
This
so
is
it's
true. Although I got distracted by it, but okay.
Yeah, you're getting distracted by it. I'm just over here on row 10 of my 40-some rows in this particular piece. So it's an interesting psychological issue as well as practical, where there are very few things, especially with, you know, phones being a distraction today. Nobody says, hey, get off those knitting needles.
That's interesting because, you know, doodling while speaking to someone is, I think, considered rude. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I can't say I've ever done it.
But yet I have literally been in faculty meetings and been in situations where, you know, you would be paying attention to someone and knitting is an approved thing to do.
I heard a little chirp. Did you just get a flash flood alert?
No, it was a message on Twitter. Message.
So. Okay. My second and last question is, I remember years ago reading some article in Scientific American or some other, you know, popular layperson type science magazine about knot theory in mathematics. Have you found anything in knitting related to knot theory?
No, I have not, but I have not been getting much into theoretical knitting. I've gotten mostly just into applied.
I think you should go into theoretical, you know, n-dimensional knitting. Could be interesting.
Oh, the fun things in future podcasts.
Yeah. Okie dokie then. A relatively short podcast this time around, and we will talk to you next time. I'll have to check with John about his spring break schedule, but we will definitely talk to you in the next couple of weeks sometime.